Today we are going to listen to the public input in regards to the proposed rental housing amendment bill that is before the portfolio committee. This process is a constitutional obligation of Parliament in ensuring that there's public participation in every legislative process. And as this portfolio committee, we are taking very seriously that obligation, as we have already invited the public. And this process is also guided by the Parliament rules. So we are executing our mandate as the committee. And I must say that the public this time around will have no complaints against Parliament, because we have gone over the period that is allocated for submissions. Normally it's 2 weeks, but we have gone over the 2 weeks. We started, they were supposed to, the last submissions were supposed to reach Parliament on the 15th of December. But even in January, beginning of January, we continued to open and give opportunity for public to comment, because at least by then, Parliament has not yet began its session. So we thought that let's give a bonus to our members of the public, so that when we come back, there won't be anyone who said I'm left behind. So we are confident that this particular committee, that everyone has been given an opportunity. The bill seeks to amend the Principal Act as amended. We will recall that the bill was promulgated in 1999, and then there was an amendment in 2007. But those amendments were related to governance issues. And this time around, the bill has been expanded to look at other sections in the Principal Act. The reason for that is because the Portfolio Committee has undertaken its oversight responsibility. We have been down to the community. We have listened to the community, their experiences in terms of the rental challenges that they are experiencing. Some of us have even witnessed what is happening in the community so far. So that was the main reason for the Portfolio Committee to approach government to say, let's extend the amendment to address our issues in the Principal Act. And other areas in the Principal Act were there, but they were not articulated in a manner, in a friendly, in a user-friendly manner So that's why the committee decided to make sure that those areas that would require more explanation, even to an ordinary person on the ground, should be added to. Secondly, the bill also put an emphasis on the tribunals, federal tribunals. Yes, the federal tribunals were supposed to be established, I think, long time ago by government, or especially in the provinces. But that process was very, very slow. And but fortunately, that by the time the bill was brought before the portfolio committee, I think most of the provinces have already established their rental tribunals. I think about 7, and I think now maybe it's only one, the same commission can assist us on that, but I believe that the majority of the provinces have established. I know my province, which is Eastern Cape, they just recently appointed the tribunal. When we were, I'm sorry, I've got something here. When we were busy interrogating the first submission from the department, we had the existing rental tribunals. They came before the portfolio committee and present their situation. I must say we were very much happy to receive that the problems that are forwarded to the tribunal, not especially the campaign, they were managing to attend to those, but only 15%. Not sure now about the percentage. There are 16 that were not there within the period of years. So I'm trying to say the rental tribunals are very serious. They are very determined in doing their work. Now, that is why the portfolio committee has looked to say, at least to make them improve in their mandate. We need to give them an opportunity to divide themselves. So that if there is a problem in south of Joburg, and then there's another hearing that has to be attended in the north, so they must not delay. 3 must go to the south and 3 must go to the north. But the decision will be a tribunal decision. Those committees will come back to a main meeting and then they will discuss the issues. Then it will be a decision of the tribunal. It will not be a decision of a single or an individual committee. They will bring issues for discussion. So there's quite a lot, but we have received the submissions from the members of the public, of which I believe that today they are here amongst us, and the first one is in Professor Dumisa, is one of them, and he is the first one to present today. The legal resource is the corner, but people are going to introduce themselves as time goes on. And I must say, we have read through the submissions and the portfolio committee. There's actually real comments, genuine comments. We really appreciate. We as the portfolio committee are committed to have discussions around those issues, and at the same time after, because we are going to continue deliberating even after today's session, which means you will receive a feedback after the committee has taken a decision on those issues. We are going to give you the feedback. Each and every stakeholder that has been forwarded its submissions before the portfolio committee, so that you are clear, you know why the portfolio committee has taken some decisions. With those few words, you are more than welcome, and you are free to engage the committee. Unfortunately, the term of this committee is going to the end, but we do encourage you, even in the next term, you must engage on the issues with the committee that is going to take over in the fifth parliament, or the fifth parliament. This is your parliament, the people's parliament, so people are free to engage. Thank you so much. I will take the opportunity to request people to introduce themselves so that we address each other appropriately. I will request the honorable government to start.
Thank you, Minister. I'm Doria Borman, a member of the committee.
I'm Makasa a member of the committee.
Good morning, Philip Mukhalapa, member of the committee.
Good morning, Roy Bula, member of this committee.
Moreno Nonge, Ngobandu Machoba, Lunga Lekumi.
Good morning, members and colleagues. My name is Peri Nkonyane from the Department of Human Settlement.
Good morning, Ilekian from PNG.
Jane Henschel from the Parliamentary Communications Service.
Dale Eddy from Public Parliamentary Office.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Pierre Fino from Banking Association.
Good morning, Ashley Samario from Ethical Political Consulting.
Good morning, I'm Wong K. Dumisa from myself.
Morning, my name is Winchala from Parliamentary Communication
Service. Morning, I'm Steve Garnett from the Legal Resource Center.
Morning, Johan Lorenzen, Legal Resources Center.
Morning, everyone. My name is Jason Clay. I'm from Pandoric Properties.
Morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Marcus Janwan from Parliamentary Legal Services.
Morning, Jerome Mokalako from Ministry.
Morning, everyone. Meeting Father, Deputy Director General.
Morning, I'm Thomas Sevi from the Office of the Teachers.
Good morning, my name is Marsha Pine from National Human Settlement.
Morning, I'm Maurice Ngomezulu, National Department of Human Settlement.
I'm Peter Judy from the National Department of Human Settlement.
Hi, my name is Chris Mbwene from Human Settlement.
one inbound. My name is Holly Shapasia, the committee secretary. Thank you so much. Let me give the opportunity to Professor Dosa.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Jotan, Molwen, Tovela, Melang, Di Majeroni, Asin, Sanbunan, Kuyemore, Namaste, Assalamu Alaikum, Itada, Maskati, Jambo. Okay, reintroducing myself, I'm Gonge Dumisa, I'm an advocate of the High Court of South Africa in Lesotho. I'm a former university professor of management at GKZN. I'm also an economic analyst and a former member of the KwaZulu-Natal Rental Housing Tribunal from 2008 to 2011. It is all these hats I wear and others not mentioned here, which influence my passion for rental housing matters. I may add that I personally paid for all the expenses I incurred flying down to the top and accommodation here. And that is what we expect from public participation, that people do things not because it is their job, but it is because if I think it's the people's parliament, then we must use the opportunity given to make input. Most of my submissions here will be based on the research I did for my published article, which is entitled The Limitations of the Rental Housing Act and the Social Housing Act Sustaining Access to Adequate Rental Housing. This was published in October 2013, last year, in the Human Settlements Review, Economics and Finance, Edition 1, which was published by the Department of Human Settlements in collaboration with Business Enterprises at the University of Pretoria. In this article, I dealt with some aspects of the human settlements legislation that blunt its effectiveness and render such laws toothless. When I say it renders such laws toothless, I am not saying they are not good. They are good laws. But there are certain problems with them which make them less effective. So I have no intention of giving a Law 101 lecture here. However, I do need to give a legislative framework so that when you look at my submissions, then you will understand where I come from and why they are important. It is important that we note that everything we do in making the housing legislation more effective must be based on the premise that everything we do must be constitutional and must also be taking into account the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa as the foundation which underpins the rights as well as all the obligations that flow from the application of the Rental Housing Act. The Social Housing Act and all other related legislation and regulations in the sphere of human settlements. The South African legislature, and I'm referring to you honorable members of parliament, has also said that our legislation must always take into consideration other relevant pieces of legislation. And in this case of human settlements, we can, and I hope no one is going to be surprised by this, because I was listening to the law report last Monday, and the attainment rate dealing with the rental housing issues just happened to refer to the Consumer Protection Act. It never refers to the Rental Housing Act. That tells you how much we must look at other legislation when we want to understand the effectiveness of our own legislation. So we must look at the Consumer Protection Act, especially Section 14 thereof, on the expiry and renewal of fixed-term agreements. These provisions, I must highlight this one, they may override any clause in the lease agreement that seeks to limit the tenant's right to cancel the lease agreement, and may also override any clauses in the lease agreement that seeks to entrench the landlord's right to cancel the lease agreement. use later on why I had to pick those two things up. And then also have to look at the pie apps. You know, when you look at the name, it makes you feel very interested. But many vendors will tell you when they think of the pie apps, they cannot even eat a pie. Okay, that pie app being the prevention of illegal eviction from an unlawful occupation of land act 19 of 1998, which highly limits the and constrains the landlord's rights to evict tenants, even in cases where the landlord's own rights are being unlawfully violated. And then to a certain extent, the National Credit Act does have some limited applications here as well. If there were also using the other legislations which fall under the Particular Portfolio Committee, the Social Housing Act, and other legislation, then the National Credit Act would have been very important. And then in doing all of these things, you must be guided by the preambles in both the Constitution, and I always have my Constitution, where it is said that the Constitution says we must recognize injustices of our past. And when we look at our Social Housing Act, it entrenches that. So look at that one, the one why I had to highlight that one. And also to improve the quality of life of all the citizens and free the potential in each person. And later on I will show that that particular part of the preamble is a problem for some of the citizens in South Africa and is a blessing for some of the citizens in South Africa. And then one particular clause in the Constitution which is very relevant for us here, section 26 of the Constitution, which gives everyone the right to access to adequate housing. And I must draw this clear distinction. It does not give everyone a right to housing. It gives everyone the right to access to housing. And some of the challenges I will highlight are related to people not understanding that distinction between a right to access housing and a right to housing. Because when I was with the KwaZulu-Natal Rental Housing Tribunal, there are many cases which we dealt with, and I dealt a lot with the people who are part of the Gauteng Rental Housing Tribunal. And I found that our cases are almost the same, where we found that there were certain tenants who unlawfully violated the landlord's right under the deliberate false belief that they are entitled to housing. So there are problems, but it does not affect the rental housing a lot. It does affect social housing, but we're not dealing with that today. So now let me confine myself to the Rental Housing Act, because that is why we are here. In applying this particular legislation, we must be guided by its very reason d'etre, that is, its reason for its existence, which is to create mechanisms to promote the provision of rental housing property, and two, to promote access to adequate housing through creating mechanisms to ensure the proper functioning of the rental housing market. Later on, I will be arguing that with the application of some of our very good law, the Rental Housing Act, we have some unintended consequences where we find then that maybe we do not really balance the two rights, and we find that some people pull out of the market where they are supposed to be providing rental housing stock because of some of the appointments they encounter. Hence, as we go through this presentation, our minds and thinking must look at the manner in which I will make my specific comments on the Rental Housing Amendment Bill. I must address B56 of 203 of 2013, and then must contextualize what I've said now in this very lengthy introductory remarks, and see if ever I'm going the right way or maybe I am misunderstanding what the Rental Housing Act should be about. And I was happy to hear from the chair that the regionals and tribunals are coming up in most of the provinces, because when I was a member of the KwaZulu-Natal Regionals and Tribunal, the only three active tribunals were Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal and the Western Cape. I will not mention what was holding up the functioning of the regionals and tribunal in the Eastern Cape. But I did mention it to the chairperson. It's a very interesting thing. Okay, so what are some of my comments on the rental housing amendment bill? But I must start with a disclaimer on this. You know, players like covering themselves in case you want to challenge them. I've got to cover myself. We have the rental housing amendment bill, which is B56 of 2013. But as you highlighted earlier on, we've had a number of other amendments in the past. So in preparing this and in writing my article, I was using the Rental Housing Amendment Bill, B21 of 2011. And so much has happened between those two bills. So, but I will try my best to qualify myself to B56 of 2013. And as I said before, please forgive me for not having the PowerPoint presentation. There were problems, but at least we're able to provide some copies of the PowerPoint presentation. Now, let me look at some of the problems which are associated with the Rental Housing Amendment Bill. And I may be wrong somewhere, and please feel free to challenge me, because maybe this is going to help me, because I want to have more articles which will flow from this discussion. When I looked at the proposed section 4B, capital B, subsection 2, I found it confusing. Unfortunately, I don't have the copy of that amendment bill, B 2013. I found it confusing because my understanding is that all children are entitled to a refund, but the way it is, that particular subsection is phrased, it creates some confusion in my mind. I'd like someone to explain that one to me. And then the subsection 4, capital D, subsection 9. This was always a problem with us at the Rental Housing Tribunal, and when I discussed people like Trevor Bailey in Gauteng and Amy Paxton in Gauteng, they told me that they also encountered those problems. When you have the estate agents coming to the Rental Housing Tribunal and there's a dispute about the refund of the deposit, they'll always tell you that, well, if you are a member of the estate agents, but then you are not supposed to refund the deposit while that money goes to the estate agency affairs. But I'm not sure about that. I'd like some answers on that one. But the main part that I'm going to look at is there is a certain subsection D, Roman 2, where it says, where the tenant fails or refuses to vacate the dwelling or rental housing property after having obtained an order of court, then that's where we had problems in KwaZulu-Natal. How can they head away around that one? I'm going to deal with it later on. Because if you go to court and you want to have that order of court, then it must be compliant and you must include therein that you understand the application of the PI Act. And in most instances, the application of the PI Act went to the disadvantage of the financially disadvantaged landlord. I must stress that one, because there is a certain thinking in our mind then that we are dealing with parties who are not equal here, that the tenants are always the very poor people who must be protected, and the landlords are the rich entities, rich corporations who can afford, and not always the case. I mean, in KwaZulu-Natal, in one of the cases we dealt with, one of the defaulters, one of the tenants who had not paid rent for 6 months that was refusing to vacate, was occupying a penthouse in Umhlanga Ridge, where the rental was 14,000 rand a month. And that is the tenant who came to the rental as a tribunal. So, and yet we have many school teachers and nurses and policemen and even cleaning ladies who are landlords say, well, funeral is only the cleaning was about one. I must have something which is going to prepare some money for my children when I pass away. They can have some income. So they invest in buying property and then rent it out. And when the person does not pay, because they depend on that rental amount to pay the bond. And when the person does not pay, the bank does not say who lives in the case on and they are blacklisted. And I know the implications of some being blacklisted, how it affects many of those people. So those are some of the things that we have to look at. And I have decided that when I address a particular problem about insisting that everything must be done only through the court, then that we may have some problems. In the article that I published, I dealt with two different cases in KwaZulu Natal, but I needed something that was current and from the newspaper then. There was a lady in Hillcrest who decided to rent the main house, a four-bedroom house, and she and her husband moved to the granny flat at the back. And the tenant in front refused, was not paying rent for more than 4 months, and they could not get them out. And in this case, they went to court for the pine application. It was granted, but please, this is South Africa. You cannot listen to the abusing people and throwing them out. So the tenant was refusing to move out. And this, in desperation, this landlord had rights to the Metro newspaper to say, please know about this. What do I do under these circumstances? And because of the PI Act and the Rental Housing Act, they could not disconnect the water to the main house. They could not switch off the electricity to the main house. So these are some of the challenges that I hope we can find a way of including them in the Rental Housing Act without those laws being found to be unconstitutional. And then there is another Westville widowed owner who found then that she was unable to sell her house because there was a tenant. I can see Mrs. Bowman is looking at me like this. I remember it was when my child was in. So I'm taking a look about the area, you know very well. So in this particular case, this particular lady who owns this particular property of mine, okay, found then that there's a person that's not paid for more than 6 months, and the person was refusing to move out. And in law, we have this particular thing about you can't forecope, okay? So if you are selling the property which already has a tenant, then the tenant has rights. So it's got to take that package. And that is for this particular person who has no entitlement to remain in this particular property. But the people who are going to move in will have no rights. So they will not buy the property until the tenant is out. So, and yet you find that the rental housing agency is unable to help under these circumstances, even though the rental housing tribunal will make the ruling and say the person must get out. But you still have to go to court, and in court they will grant you that eviction order. And it is very difficult to push those people out. And then we also have another, I have to use some of these legal terms. I am not trying to spoil the presentation, but it is because it is very important that we look at them in their legal context. We have the legal concept of mandament slash body. And that is, if ever someone
had certain rights. And if we are challenging that person's right to that right, what you must do, you cannot take law into your own hands. So you cannot chuck a person out because they're not being etc. So you must first go to court and allow the situation to be what it was before you were seen to be acting unlawfully. And many landlords find themselves in this particular position now that when they actually chuck people out, then it is said, bring them back first and then come and ask you to keep. So these are some of the problems then that I find that the Rental Housing Act is not addressing. And for you to find this out, you must be cost the legal services amount to thousands of rands. And I must say, being now a full-time practicing advocate, yes, I enjoy getting that money from people who want me to help them to do that. But is it fair? Is it fair really to expect people who don't have so much money to be paying so much because of people who do not want to pay them? And these are some of the challenges. And then I look at proposed section 4, capital E, 11, where it says that it is important that landlords must facilitate provision of utilities to the dwelling. However, I just feel that the way in which the situations were dealt with is not so clear. So we may need to revisit that and rearrange some of those subsections. Because I believe that when you look at the Rental Housing Agencies now, it is not compulsory to have three inspections. It is compulsory to have inspections at the end of the lease agreement, but not at the beginning. I believe that we must make three inspections compulsory. The reason for that is because in most cases, all of the trouble, all of the problems we dealt with were related to what happened when the first moved in. The person will see, when I need my closet back because the landlord says that I will not refund because there are these problems. But those problems were there when I just moved in. So because the institutions are not compulsory, then you do not know how to make the decision. And when you've got doubts, I must say it's a very difficult thing. Then you err on the side of the tenant. And you may find that you err on the side of the tenant. And then you may find that maybe the tenant is not right in that particular case. The thing was not there. Something which happened before, which happened after they moved in. So I think we can revisit that section 4, capital B. And then I have some recommendations for subsection 4, capital B4, where I feel that we need to address this issue about pre-inspection. I'll develop it. We have to have something to the effect that may generate. The tenant and the landlord must jointly, before the tenant signs the lease agreement or before the tenant moves into the dwelling, inspect the dwelling to ascertain the existence of any defects or damage with a view to determine the landlord's responsibility for rectifying any defects or damage, or with a view to listing any such defects or damage in the pre-inspection of the court. We do not have any clause in the amendment which deals with a particular issue in particular. And this takes me back to some of the problems I've highlighted there with people having problems with tenants. As it is today, I'm speaking mostly about the landlords, because I think we are doing a lot to cover the tenants, but we don't cover the landlords a lot, and we've got to balance this. It transpires from a number of case rulings by both the Gauteng Rental Housing Tribunal. I think that I learned a lot with Mloi in KwaZulu Natal, was the chairperson there, so it was easy for me to get most of the information when I was a member there, and sometimes I gave it time for even for some of the meetings. So when I request here, now I remember some of the, I had to go as far as in the northwest to deal with rental housing issues.
And in Gauteng, I've been dealing with the their former chairperson, Trevor Bailey, for a long time. And so his members were quite willing to share some information with me for that particular attitude. And then I found then that from a number of cases, both in Gauteng and in KwaZulu-Natal, many different landlords found themselves being forced to resort to unlawful acts such as disconnecting services, locking out tenants, and even using what we call the Gakasha approach. For those of you who do not know what the Gakasha approach is, on TV in the past, see, for some of us who were born a long time ago, when TV started in South Africa, there was one character in one thing which was called Good Night, Gakasha. He was always selling a knock deal, and he would sell by landlords. If ever you owed 100 rands, he would hit one of your knees, and if ever you were owing 500 rands, you'd hit both knees. So you had to make such choices. So many landlords find them that, and this is real, many landlords find them that sometimes they have to hire some criminal elements to go and physically, if not violently, collect outstanding rent and or physically remove misbehaving tenants from rental housing premises. In fact, this is so serious that let me say what I'm saying as it is now. I will deny it if someone confronts me outside this room. There was one hearing which was held where there was one tenant was not paying for over 2 years. She was a teacher. And you had this particular landlord who would not get his rent. And the tenant was refusing to move out. And whenever he came, she would just disappear. And one time, one member of the rental housing tribunal was so angry about this thing, she turned from using English and moved to IsiZulu and said to this landlord, outside the hearing, "Hey, well, I don't know how I'm going." And then this landlord, "Don't you have brothers?" And then this landlord said, "I do. Why?" "I am a tenant for 2 years. I mean, there's nothing to do with the room. Okay? Some of these things, if ever using the law doesn't work, you just have to use the... So these are some of the challenges when you can find a member of the tribunal forced to actually say those things because they're dedicated people abusing the laws, then you have to look at this. And then I'm about to come to the end.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I wish to apologize to what I should have highlighted to you that you've got 30 minutes. Now you are over with 2 minutes, but I'm going to give you 3 minutes. But the others will not get that.
Okay.
So by 5:10, you are saying.
Yeah. And then the other sections then that I have a problem with are section 9(1)(a). I think that can be rephrased to read. A chairperson who is suitably qualified, preferably with a legal qualification and has necessary expertise and exposure to rental housing matters. The reason why I am saying this thing is because I have a problem with people who do not have the legal background to be appointed the chairperson of rental housing tribunals, because I find them that you've got a lot of legal processes that you've got to deal with. I have the advantage that I was an economist, management person, also a lawyer, so I would look at both sides. But if ever I was just a professor of management without my legal background, I would have had a problem in chairing some of the hearings then. And then section 9, what I read, I may be wrong, it does not deal with the appointment of the deputy chairperson, and I believe that all legislation, most laws deal with the appointment of the deputy chairperson as well. And then section 17A, capital A, I found it to be weak. And I then said, if ever we were to copy from the Medical Claims Act, The medical scheme act deals with the appointment of appeals committees and the appeals board to deal with some of the complaints. We may adopt the thing for the rental housing sector. And then lastly, section 17, I find it to be undermining section 17A. And then lastly, and I'm out of here, is that when we look at the Rental Housing Act, we must make sure then that we look at the rights and obligations of the tenant, the rights and obligations of the landlord, and not assume then that every landlord is a bully, and not assume that every tenant is a innocent victim, because we have many troublesome tenants that we have troublesome landlords. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I was hearing very valuable information, but I will give the opportunity to members to interact. Members, we have got only 20 minutes. Only 20. Mama, not a comment, please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to Professor Dumisa for the presentation. I think it is quite clear. It's just the last part on page 2, section 9, the point or section 17A on appeals. You are saying it is very weak, but you are not suggesting to us how to strengthen it. So I mean, like you have done in the other sessions, you have actually made some amendments. It helped us in the committee, you know, because as far as you are concerned, it's all right. But you see that it is weak. But you are not suggesting to us how we can strengthen that section 17. And the same thing, section 17, the very last sentence there on page 3, that section 17 reminds a 17. I don't know whether it's because we already having for time, because I would have expected you, for instance, to tell us how Section 17 seriously undermines Section 17A. Without that information for me, it doesn't really give me an idea of the question, what is wrong with that section.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for your presentation. And you obviously speak with a great passion for this. I want to just pick up on the point that you raised under section 4B and 4, where you talk about the tenant and the landlord must jointly, before the tenant signs the lease agreement, and going around and doing the inspections. I'm just asking you, you say that this doesn't tie up nicely, but in the actual wording that we've got, or damage with a view to registering any such defects or damage, now you prefer to use in the pre-inspection report, is registering and pre-inspection report, not a, and I think it is critically important. That, and I mean, I've done a bit of renting in my life, that you do go in and have a proper inspection with written down things so that you know where the faults are. So if we could just have some explanation about that.
Thanks very much, Chair. Thank you, Professor Dumisa. I think you have given us a very pragmatic view, and you show that you were very much extensively involved in terms of rental scope is concerned. I just want you to lash on the issue of the section 4B9 of the use of the Estate Agency Act when you say it compromised the concept of deposit refund. And I think what you've given us is a very food for thought, because you are saying to us we need to consider very extensively the balancing of the landlord's rights and obligations vis-à-vis
the tenants. And I think you've made a very salient point there, that we might be looking at the issue of the tenants and looking at them as poor. But you've given us an overarching concept to say we've got to look at the issue of the landlords. So I just want you to unpack that one on the issue of deposit, because of what we want to do is the issue of redress and how do we tie it up in terms of conflict resolution so that the issue of the deposit, the refunds, it ties up with the issue of the pre-inspection report. Because the entire bone of contention is about that there was never a pre-inspection report, hence when the tenant wants to vacate and then the deposit can be refunded. You know, those kind of dynamics. But most importantly, I want us to, I know we are not dealing with the PI Act, but I want you to give us a hypothetical case here that seems to say, do you say that the problem is the issue of the lack of implementation of the PI Act or the marrying of the PI Act with the Rental Act, and how do we navigate ourselves around that one? Because of surely the PI Act is one of the bone of contention, but it's not a subject of discussion. But I think you've brought it up because of it's a cause and effect. You know, it's a variable in terms of research language. It's a variable that impacts on the rental stock. It's the implementation of the PI Act and how do you see that correlation moving forward. And then lastly, on the issue of subsection 17, when it says 17A undermines 17A, because of the view there that we are putting in that those decisions of the tribunal are up for review or the tribunal can rescind this decision. Are you saying that also undermines the whole process? But thank you very much for giving us a view of ensuring that we balance the issue of the landlords and not only seeing it from a view of the tenants, because of that's what we intend to do here, is to bring both two together in terms of their redress. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, I'm a little bit covered with the questions received now. My mind was on your conclusion that the right of the landlord and the right of the tenant. Sometimes it happens that we the landlord will forget that the tenant has got from them the rights. The same thing that we done now that the property is maybe it is sort of the sole one that we was what I said.
Thank you so much. I believe that when you came here, you were also expecting not only the questions, but I think you were also expecting the views of the committee on these matters. First and foremost, you have raised, in fact, you have put an emphasis on the rights of landlords, of which we are together on that one. But you have not come out what is expected, because rights are right. And as this portfolio committee, we have came up because if you look at the previous situation, when Bill referred already, but you know, the fellowship, which is about the government, I'm going to have a time, But as this portfolio committee, we sat down and said, in the country as a whole, the rental stock, the rental market, there is a rental market there. Those huts are rented to the teachers. Nurses in the clinics,
unfortunately, in my other home, in my Katia, we've got so many police stations in rural areas. Those policemen, so, the local market will never, never pay me. So to me, in my view, this is a threat to say people are going to pull out something about this day. Because people, they go to work, they don't need to have a house. For instance, I'm here in Cape Town, let alone that I'm here in Parliament. If I was a staff member employed by this Parliament, and I don't have the intention to leave my country. I love my small town. I enjoy to be there. Matatia. You want to matatia that I should everyone who's there. I greet everyone in the street. I speak to everyone in the street. They know me. I'm there. So I enjoyed my life there. But I would love one day to have a flat in Cape Town to rent for a town. So I'm trying to say, it will never finish. Let's agree to that one. So the people who are coming that aspect, I don't think it's fair. But we need to address the issues, the genuine issues as they are raised. Let us address them. We're not disputing if there are problems. But bring the problems, let's discuss them, and come up with the recommendations that this one we believe we can address it. I'm not referring to you, I'm referring even to others. Because all this majority of this, they are threatening us to say, no, people are going to pull away. They pull away, that's a lamb. They want, Prof, they want. But that's important. We must build this South Africa together. That is important. You're not the problem of people who are refusing to vacate. This bill does not protect them. It doesn't. There's no way in this bill that is proposing that those NS Marayet, Bakayet, because what we are saying, let's follow the process. South Africa Umthetho, the Constitution. And we don't agree with Mabathathelwa amanzi. Very true. But follow the other processes. And then, at the end of the processes, Umthetho, there are law enforcement agencies. Who can have a person who can report? If those people, they don't have to attend, the law is in favor of the landlords. If by a given those people must go there and put other laws. The problem in South Africa, you people think that if Parliament is going to have a bet in the ones that the nitty gritty, because we have got a lot of role players in this country. There's quite a lot of red flags that can come and make sure that Umthetho, we are in the middle of the area. Leo, Tina is this portfolio committee. We are taking a decision. Even if the department is aware of the decision that we have taken, that we are not going to amend. Because PI Act is one of the laws that has been passed by Parliament that we are not even sure that it has been started to be implemented. One of the things that we have got, that department, even government, our government department, they went to the court and were asking, who's the son? I will get them to court and challenge the citizen. That's fair, man. We want the implementation of the text that we've done, and then we come and say, this act is unimputable. Then you put X forward. We are not yet convinced. Because what we are saying, that X, what is lacking there, government should have established mechanisms of monitoring. Lava kukade muva pale wakala mkuku. The air chukut within so many hours. Of course. Ababashi. Bye-bye, Ababashi for 10 years. Ababakut. Baku yiba zuki pala hende. Ha, so, these people are not hiding in buildings. Babuja said they should be young and large. This is everything. And then after 10 years, you come and say, you are vacating those people. Where have you been? For that, yes. So I'm trying to say, I'm glad that you came up with this issue, but there are other presentations that are going to assess that. So I thought it's proper that I raised what we will be leaving. So I raised this because it's a matter that has been raised by many people. Otherwise, the other issues we really, really appreciate, but we still need you to come and, to assist us in other areas. And more especially, the other issues that you have raised, your recommendations are more than welcome. It's not necessary that you can do them today. You can go and think about them overnight. So if you have managed to these issues, it would be very much appreciated when the investigation could respond to some issues, because we are going to have the 3 minutes.
I think what would make more sense for me, so that I do justice to all the questions from Umam Jobe, Umet Oman, Remohala, and Tatu Majoba, is that let me apply my mind to your question so that I give you detailed responses to. Because when I said when I said section 17A is weak, what I was saying, I started by saying at the beginning that the Rental Housing Act is good and South Africa needs it. And the amendments are good. But I think even that which is good can still be made better. So I was simply saying, because fortunately for me I wear these many hats. So at the Council of Medical Schemes, I am at the Council member and I sit on the Appeals Committee. So deal with all these medical scheme challenges, etc. And I see how it can actually help to facilitate those things that if those things were to court. So I'm saying even within the human settings environment, then we can have something like that. So when you say something is weak, you're not necessarily saying then that it cannot be used. You're simply saying there may be a better way around the child and can learn from other entities. On the issue of the trade agents, I am confused because we keep on hearing trade agents saying that they are not subject to, they don't want to refund people. And I am saying they must be refunded. So there's something which is wrong with that particular Act 112 of 19, whatever. The deposit must be given to anyone. That must be the right, and no one has the right to say where the deposit money is put elsewhere. I feel that so. I agree with you then. Then on the issue of the high expenses, Pakistan has said, I think I will send you a very detailed thing here because it is a problem, Madam Chair. Because what is happening is people will say, I have a 2 year old, a 2 month old child there. I've got Uma, no Gogo, who are 96 and 110. So if I go out, where are they going to? So it's up or even abuse. So these are some of the unintended consequences. Like, I'd rather send you a detailed response to this. Otherwise, rest assured, I am not part of the regular responses who are criticizing everything that the parliament is doing. We are on the same track. It's just that even when they're on the same track, there are certain things by which you can approach differently.
I think the issue of the SSD dances, it was just because it was so late. It's one of the acts that are supposed to be amended by portfolio committee. And the portfolio committee, we wish that it could be us, but unfortunately. But we will make an input even if we are not here in this committee, because we believe that there's quite a lot of unfairness that is in terms of transformation that exactly sector is very, very behind. So, but we have opened our eyes. We'll see how to deal with this. Because rental aid is going to be implemented by all the housing or residential rental market. This act is going to go across the board. So we'll see how can we get around the issues that we've raised.
Last.
Yes.
I just want to assure you that I know when they are referring to all people threatening to pull out, etc., it starts becoming irritating to the legislature. People don't want to engage us, they are coming up with threats. But what I am highlighting here, I am saying, and sure this is a fact, I am saying you've got many disadvantages, people, I'm talking of people of all races, all colors and all ages, who are financially disadvantaged, who invest the last money they have in rental housing stock, and people, and because they want to invest in their future, they are told, don't put all your money in the bank. So when people don't pay, that property is repossessed and they lose, that we need to protect. And those people can be Magadian, can be Maholerin, can be Ndolbeni, can be Kofi Fontaine. They are
amen. Thank you. Why am I like it about friends and such fight about it? I wanna go like all these flights on the most corner fell out 10 PM.
Everyone else, but I will continue reading from the hard copy in the interest of time. high level. At a high level, the reason we're back here in Maine today is that mortgages have an exposure of over R1 trillion to the bond market, of which about 800 billion rand is to the residential housing market, and the commercial banks probably control about 95% of the residential mortgage market. So this is a critical piece of legislation to us, and I just want to put that into context. At a high level, the presentation looks to suggest that we believe that it is necessary for a rewrite of this act to happen, that one can't make mere amendments for two reasons. The one is that it's 15-year-old legislation, and there's been a number of pieces of legislation that impact on this that have been introduced post it, and it is not aligned to those pieces of legislation. And the Prof spoke about a little bit about that earlier on in his presentation. I think the second thing that the committee, or the drafters of this legislation, have not taken into account is that there are numerous court cases, a lot of which have gone in front of the Constitutional Court, the highest court, about that, and made certain rulings. And this piece of legislation will actually conflict with the outcomes of those rulings and just place the department in the middle, because the act has not been aligned to those developments over the last 15 years. And if you look at this presentation on the very last page of it, I have really listed seven court cases that I believe will guide this committee in looking at some of the things that they need to consider when they actually look at a piece of legislation and amendments to that legislation. Really implementing these amendments simply going to put you on the back foot. The Constitutional Order's rule, your legislation will not stand. So that's the high level context of what I'm trying to present here today, and I'll try to argue the points just now. Under overview, our presentation is very similar to the one that we made in April 2012. We fully support the need for government to strengthen and address shortcomings within the Act. In particular, we welcome the attempts to improve and strengthen rental tribunals, to increase the levels of transparency in respect of lease agreements, and to improve landlord-tenant lease agreements and processes. That whole section of responsibilities and obligations and pre-inspections, I think it's absolutely wonderful, and it does bring clarity, and the minister's ability to create a straw man guideline that will actually guide landlords in creating the right contracts is very positive. But we do have concerns, and let me touch on them, and I've broken them up into material and technical concerns. Material concerns, I think, if I look at the context of this bill, and I think from a government perspective, you aim very much to protect the poor and the vulnerable. That is the role of the state. And then you have a normal competitive market. And the Prof gave an example of somebody with a rental of 40,000 rand a month. They don't need protection from the state. But unfortunately, this act actually covers the entire market. And that is the difficulty that we've got. Because what we have found from a lot of our customers who are landlords and rent properties is they do things illegally because they are so frustrated with the time and the cost that it takes to actually get evictions of people who should not be protected by the state. And we've seen it in the abuse, the high-tech buildings, particularly in inner cities where it can take you upwards of 2 years to actually follow a legal process to get those criminals out of that building. And obviously there's a big cost attached to that. And whilst I hear the chairperson saying the landlords will never withdraw from this market, the way the market works, Madam Chair, is that as with money in my pocket, I've got to decide which asset class I want to go into, be it property, be it equity, and so on. And I'll make the decision based on the return on investment that I will get. If it's going to, the process is going to inhibit that, I will move into an area which is more investor friendly than property, especially as the returns on rental property have been the low inflation for the last couple of years, and the property boom that we had up into 2007 that bubbles burst, and it's time to repair itself, and it may well be another 10, 15 years before we see another boom. So the big capital gains that investors got is not going to be as big over the next 10 years as what they enjoyed in the past, and which actually counted a lot of the frustrations that they have encountered. I think more importantly, we are trying, and we have been involved with entities such as CUP, which is involved in the inner city of Johannesburg in particular. We have four landlords trying to get into the market. The reality of the more difficult you make through legislation for landlords, the riskier is to a mortgagee. And the outcome of that is that what your banks will do is that they will tighten their lending criteria because they recognize the risk attached to this, and what you actually do is you start pushing up the small landlords, and if you start increasing the pricing of your loans to those landlords, they pass the cost on to tenants, and then it's the marginally poor, you can just barely scrape the rental that'll actually be pushed out, so they actually provide financial exclusion. So I think it actually frustrates everyone, quite frankly. We believe, and our recommendation is clear, we need to break this piece of legislation into two boxes. One which deals with the poor and vulnerable, who deserve and should get state protection. And that's where the focus is on things like rent control, overcrowding, minimum standards, eviction stop units, etc. I think there's a lot of application in the Social Housing Act, the Prevention of Illegal Eviction Act, that should also be focused on the poor and the vulnerable. And then you have the normal market, which is where the focus we now need should be on the contract and the governance that surrounds that contract. Some of our material concerns are that what we're going to find is unnecessary and costly court changes for the state, because landlords have got this raft of legislation that supports what they want to get out of it, so they will pursue the matter through the courts. I spoke about landlord flight, and I know the chairperson doesn't like that, but the reality is that that's what will happen. The private sector will go wherever there's money to be made, and the most money out of a particular area of focus. And I can tell you in the Johannesburg inner city, for instance, a number of the big landlords are very concerned with the framework and where it's going at the moment, and they have been attempts by some of them to actually start disposing of their stock, to sell their stock into the open market. As I spoke to you just now, the costs get pushed up and the access becomes more difficult as vendors experience increased lending risk. And then I think the big thing, and this is the unintended consequence, there are a lot of people that are getting involved and using this piece of legislation and PIE to their own end. Government do not wish to protect. And the affluent example that the Prof gave is now about 40,000 rand a month is a very clear example of it. And somehow this legislation needs to speak to the two bosses I was referring to. The last point I have on this particular page is that in 2007 we were part of a commission into the evictions of families when they defaulted on properties, and there was a human rights commission hearing. And they made a whole lot of recommendations around the role of the various people and what they should do, including the banks, including the state, including intermediaries, sheriffs and so on. And they found quite a lot of abuse in that area. I think there would be value in this committee reading that report. And then I think you also need to think about taking cognizance of what the commission actually suggested. And essentially what it was today is saying is that the state is responsible not only for putting poor and the vulnerable, giving them opportunities for access to housing up front, and all our subsidy programs are focused on that area, but today I am affluent, tomorrow I am vulnerable and poor if I lose my job. There is an onus on the state to actually provide me with support post my having initially enjoyed that assistance from the state. That's what the recommendation of the Human Rights Commission was. It's actually supported by the Constitutional Court in its matter with Joe Metro. And it, for me, it serves not purpose for the committee to allow amendment to the bill without addressing that particular issue. If you want to come sit there, how do we do this case?
Legislation requires that all agreements need to be in writing, and it was the thing. thinking was is that, just by actions, one would be able, you know, verbally, one would be exactly able to enter into contracts. So you don't want to actually have all the formalities of that project, you know, sort of legislation applying to housing. And of course, you know, the issues around tribunals and whatnot, which are the positive. But having said that, one of the things that has happened since then is, and we go back to 1999 when the initial effort was done, then the Consumer Protection Act comes in. So now, if you exclude from the DC of Land Act, the Consumer Protection Act applies to the DC legislation and it creates an imbalance. As a tenant, I have to give you 20 written days notice of my intention to get out of a contract with the US. As a landlord, if you have a 2-year rental agreement with me, you're bound to stick to that 2-year contract. That's the implication of not looking at other pieces of legislation and aligning this to that legislation. Section 9, I think it tries to create a balance in expertise within tribunals as well as legal, consumer, and legal expertise concerns, which is great. I think that's exactly what one needs to probably members of the system. However, with the issue that we have with that is what happens if there are bigger tribunals. The particular wording of the census says that there shall be no more than 2 such persons in each of those categories. So if you have a tribunal of 9 people, you can't put more than 2 people in each of those categories. One needs to just look at changing the wording to actually accommodate this, get that balance. We have a particular concern with the regulation section 15. I think there has to be public consultation on that in terms of all other pieces of legislation for the last number of years. It is a lot that when regulations are concerned to be by a minister, that they put it out in law form, they become public commentary for 30 days. In this particular piece of legislation, all the ministers required to be consulted with a couple of parliamentary committees and put in irrespective of consequences of the understanding of those committees as to the impact it will have on the proper functioning of the market. I think the efficient functioning of the market, I've spoken about the concerns there. The one I want to pull out and highlight here this morning is if one does implement geographic area-based regulations, it will result in patchy development. The way the market works is a landlord, if I have one of those scrupulous landlords that really wants to abuse my tenants, I will go and find an area where the regulations are not as strict and I will go and meet in that area. So I think that's something that one needs to address. I think it should be a national regulatory framework and it should be generic enough to actually do broad activation to the controls that the department is looking for them. And I think there should be an onus on the municipality to actually enforce what needs to be done against those scrupulous landlords through bylaws and so on. Our recommendations, they are there for everyone to see. Again, it gets back to the consultation period and the breaking up of those boxes of legislation to two pieces, as poor and vulnerable versus a competitive legal market. And then just a technical point, and it's just a wording matter. The land, under clause 64B2, the landlord has a right to where the applicant fails or refuses to vacate the dwelling, repossess the rental housing property. The landlord will not actually repossess the property. It will actually obtain an order of protection from the court. You could have a landlord who has a mortgage over their property. Repossession implies that I realize my security, whereas the landlord would simply be obtaining an order of protection. And we would just suggest that that gets taken.
than 30 minutes. Stop now.
Thank you very much, Presenter, for the presentation, and also thank you for the support that you have indicated to the committee. But I have to put it this. Section 15 does not imply that the public participation is denied. This clause refers to a situation where the law has been passed by Parliament. Then when it comes to the implementation of that particular law, you will find discrepancies. People will complain and say this legislation that was passed by Parliament is oppressing us. It does not say whatever they say that is going to be done. And then when we intervene as Parliament and make follow-up to find out where is the problem, we will be told that the problem is in the location. Somewhere, somehow, people tend to change the law, the regulations. Yet the regulations are not meant to develop another legislation. They are meant to implement that particular legislation. So somehow. So it's for Parliament to ensure that regulations are aligned to the legislation. So please feel free. We are very much serious about the participation. Even the department, when they bring those regulations before us, because we took a resolution to say in each and every law now we pass, that section must be invited for us to make sure that legislation is as it is upon majority. So feel free. That one I thought is important to clarify it. Otherwise when they come before us, even we are busy with the regulations HDA, we have dealt with the social housing regulations, we request them to bring to us the public input so that we check how have they responded to the public before we even consider our submissions that have been made to Parliament. So please say you are covered, public covered. See the Parliament. Member Sara Bowman, please, Mama.
Thank you very much. You've put a lot into your presentation. I think what I need to say is that this committee is very concerned that by the time we come to the end of the product, we will have a good piece of legislation. Our intent is that it should be user-friendly, and I think your opening remarks did state that under the rights and obligations of the tenants and the landlord as well. And I think that has been our intent. However, I want to ask, because you've raised quite a few very important things here today, and you started off by saying that you think we really need to rewrite this legislation, this Act. And you know, when this first came to us in Parliament, we actually took it beyond what the department brought to us, and you know, because we felt that it needed a lot more due to it, and so we took it further. Now you come this morning and you say, we really do need to rewrite it. And so I say to you, in your opinion, with all that you have brought here this morning, do you think that if we were to have another look at some of the amendments that we've made and sort of redo them a bit here and there, that we will still have a piece of good legislation, although you're saying that it needs to be rewritten? Is it that, or can we actually do the amendments and still have a good piece of legislation?
Yeah, thanks very much, Chief. Thank you very much for the banking association. I think you've given us, again, an eye-opener. I think one thing, just to add on what Honorable Bowman said, is to say, based on the constitutionality, because that is our premise, everything we do is that our Bible is the Constitution. And I've seen you make a statement that says it might be potentially constitutionally contested at the Constitutional Court. So I'm saying at this current format, it's unconstitutional. Is that what you are saying? That the bill that we have amended thus far seems to be unconstitutional. And I think your point of linking it with the other legislation, as also the professor, is well noted. And I think we will have to look at that in terms of it. But again, you are also bringing the same issue that Prof has brought in terms of the time, because of you are also saying the issue of the time and cost for evictions and everything. And you know, the chair says, look, the problem is not an act, the problem is the implementation. Would you agree with this statement? Because of the problem with the PIE Act and with the municipalities, I know some guys going to say to us, they don't have the resources and the capacity to implement it. But that is a part of the problem. Because these evictions happen within a particular municipal jurisdiction. And the municipality is the one that is supposed to do the actual job. So it gives us a dilemma there. And in terms of that, and based on what the prophet said in terms of the abuse of the PIE Act, it gives us a dilemma. So again, it's a question of how do we marry the issue of the PIE Act vis-a-vis the rental stock. And I think the point that you are making about distinguishing between the two markets, the poor, the vulnerable, and the competitive market, I think it's sound. Hence, the social house was meant to look at, you know, the poor, the vulnerable, and this one is a market. Because I think in one of this legislation, we cannot distinguish between the two markets. We have to put them all in one basket, because we are looking at a hut in Matadiel and an upmarket rental in Johannesburg. So it is sometimes difficult to distinguish the two, but protect the rental market, because 60% of people live in urban areas, which about 55% end less than 3,500, which gives you the rental stock in any case. And I think your point is very salient, and I hope Salga is appreciating this one, of making sure that the alternative accommodation part is put into the IDPs of the municipalities. Because of the part of the problem is they are the implementers on the ground. And if their IDP does not look at this, then it's crisis management all the time. Because evictions are happening and the fire is clear. 24 hours is not eviction happening, alternative accommodation. So you're right in terms of the IDP. And I think it's one thing that we will emphasize with Salga in terms of that. And I think the transition period share is one thing that we have to look at in terms of saying, when this becomes effective, what happens to the current status of the list? Those that are verbal, are they valid? So it's one thing that we need to say. But I think the number, when we did discuss it, I think we said 12 months or so, or, yeah, we will explicitly put it to say, what is the cut off period of the enactment of the bill, so that people know that within that period they've got, you know, space to remedy those things. And I think Section 15, the chair has dealt with it. By virtue of it being gazetted, it means public participation. Because once you gazette, then you open to opinion. So nothing gets gazetted without public participation. So rest assured in terms of public participation. Maybe we might get there to just mention it in layman's terms that there will be publication. But by virtue of gazetting, you mean you are putting it out for public participation. Thanks very much. Thank you for your very opportunity.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sul, and thank you to the Bundle Association for the presentation also. And I think what I appreciate here also is the fact that I think for almost every point you have raised, you are suggesting a definite and clear amendment. So it will be up to the committee to consider those. One hand go through all of them, but I find that a good number of them useful when we now sit down to consider, you know, the presentation. So thank you for that. Now this question of public participation, I think it's not really a big problem, but I just wanted to say we should not forget that the parliamentarians are actually representatives of the people also. So if we are saying that the minister will come back to the MPs, as to the member of parliament, it's almost like saying the minister will be coming back to the people, you see, but represented by the parliamentarians. But then in our country, it has become a practice, and actually it is almost like a demand that as much as is possible, there must be consultation. And when the public is involved, the public must participate. So I don't think we have a problem with that proposal. But I just wanted to say, we must also remember that MPs are actually representing the people. Secondly, Chairperson, I think my point has been raised by Honorable Alafa on the question of the two categories of the market. I'm also of the feeling that I don't think that it should be, let me not say it won't be possible, it may be possible, but for me I'm not sure if it would be quite right to definitely categorize, you know, the two markets, the poor market and the other market within the same legislation, or are we talking about two different legislations? And to me that also contradictory to the principle that wherever possible, we are trying to bring our people together, because before this is how people were separated in South Africa, and as much as is possible, we must bring them together. The legislation covers everyone, and therefore those clauses that apply to each market, in my opinion, will be implemented accordingly. So everyone is covered in the legislation. The other point is that of the tribunals. You are suggesting that rather than saying we must have this qualification and that qualification in each of the committees that are going to deal with the complaints, you are suggesting we should merely say one third of the tribunals. But if you say one third of the tribunal, would that cover the concern of the committee in the sense that we are saying in each of those committees there must be certain specific qualifications? It's not just the one third in terms of numbers, but also it must be certain qualifications in each committee. Now, I'm not sure if your suggestion covers that. Maybe you can unpack that for me. I will be happy with that. Thank you, Chairperson.
The last point, I think, has not been a response. The proposed recommendation to say let's remove section 2.5. The reason for that section. Governments have the responsibility of ensuring that when a legislation has been passed by Parliament, they must implement the legislation. They must come back to Parliament and report the impact of that.
there has been a tendency of national departments dispersing funds to the province as well to the municipalities. And then they will come to us and say, 9% of our budget is dispersed to provinces. So they do not want to take the responsibility and accountability of those funds. Whereas those funds have been appropriated by Parliament to the national government. We don't appropriate funds to provinces or to municipalities. The people who come before Parliament with the business plans have been coordinated by them, the national department. They will come to us and convince us. And then we appropriate those funds to them. So we follow them. They must be accountable. So they must follow the people that they dispersed funds to them. So it's a matter of responsibility and accountability. It's just simple. That's how these things happen. So that's how, even the department, when they got these two deals, they removed it. And it was the necessary, that no way. Bring it back, plant it. And they'll bring it. Tomorrow, they will come and get it. Tomorrow. Because we want them to be accountable. So we won't say here, DG must come. We are going to say the minister, because he is the one who is the accounting officer. I mean the accounting also, authority, not officer, authority. When you go on the designation government minister, this mandate to a minister, my minister must do. His or her mandate. They're not going to go and do the monitoring process. He will create mechanisms. So I'm sure you are here, but you can respond to some of the concerns that have been raised by the members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. We have to say that's another good sound. I think there is still the easy one. There's a lot of fast questions that I haven't been wanting to do correctly. The first is the one about the composition of tribunals. My wording is perhaps a little bit crude. Essentially, if I understand what you're trying to do, is you're trying to get a balance in the representation that you've got. You've got legal people, you've got consumer people, and you've got rental expertise. I think those are the three levels of expertise. Or the point I was just trying to make was, if you have a committee of 12 people, the actual wording in the bill says no more than two of those 12 people will be a rental expert or a consumer expert or a housing expert. That's the way I've read that particular piece of legislation. And I'm just suggesting that if you're wanting to create that balance, put one third in when they can cater for any number of people in tribunal. That was just my interpretation of what the wording says. I might be wrong. The second one was the point made around categories and the intent to bring our nation together. I don't dispute that at all. Maybe my wording is again a little bit crude, but the state's role, whilst it looks after all its citizens, in particular, is only on the state to protect the poor and the vulnerable. And I was just suggesting that you break the two pieces, all this legislation in two pieces, because the problem with any form of legislation is every action creates a reaction. So you have your legal fraternity that will try and put holes in the legislation for the unscrupulous and the criminals. And we've seen it in PAR, we've seen it in the Rental Housing Act, and we heard from the prof earlier today about the abuse that he saw in the KZN tribunal. And it's somehow that one takes this legislation, has hard legislation, that prevents that abuse taking place. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't protect high-income earners by making sure the right governance and leasehold and leases are in place. All that should be there. It's this thing that I actually abuse what the intent of the legislation is. That's crude wording, and you know, that's the sort of context. The first question I got was the one about the rewrite. You know, that again is probably crude wording. What I'm trying to suggest is that if you look at this piece of legislation, its origin was 1999. At that time, there were a number of pieces of legislation that impact on it that were not in place. The Consumer Protection Act is quite a big one because it does provide consumers with protection, and it creates a framework. And I'm just trying to suggest that when one looks at an amendment, one aligns this act and its amendments to that particular piece of legislation, be it the Consumer Protection Act, be it the EIE, be it the Social Housing Act, the Estate Agent Affairs Board. I know it's going to come up with a new act later this year. You've got the Insolvency Act that I mentioned earlier on, the Formal Leases Act, and somehow the drafters of the legislation need to look at all the related information and draw a big Spider-Man of what the various clauses in those acts say to make sure that all those 7 or 8 different pieces of legislation are all aligned. I think there would be great value in that. And then if there are amendments needed in some of that other legislation, that actually happens, you know, not just to say excluded from the Insolvency Act, but the Insolvency Act doesn't get challenged as an example. Then there was a question around, do I believe that this bill act and its amendments are constitutional? Absolutely not. I think it could be some legislation. I think it's right to protect consumers, and tenants are vulnerable. And if it creates a framework that creates that balance between landlord and tenant, then it's a superb piece of legislation. So I think it's certainly not unconstitutional. What I was arguing, though, is that if the regulations come through and impose conditions on landlords which are in conflict with court cases that have been to our constitutional court, what's going to happen is that your landlords will simply revert to what the courts have said and take the matter to court. And this piece of legislation is trying to do what it's trying to do, protect, is going to find itself in this invidious position of trying to protect the wealthy, where the Constitutional Court has already said the Rental Housing Act has got no need to actually look after those people. It should look after the poor and vulnerable. And I think that's what I was trying to suggest. It's certainly not unconstitutional. I think it's very important that there is a raft of legislation that creates that balance in place to protect some of the abuse that we've seen in the rental market, particularly amongst the poor and the vulnerable and student accommodation and so on. You then asked the question around PIE, and again, it's in the same context of what I was talking about just now. PIE in itself, the intent of it is very good, but it gets abused. And you're wanting to restrict it to where it focuses on what it intends to do, and it doesn't allow that abuse to actually happen for those people that you're not wanting to protect. I think those are the questions that I've got, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if I've answered them correctly or if there's any questions that I haven't answered. I think I've got 5 minutes, but I guess there's nothing.
Kind of forgotten about it. When you were talking about the 12 members, where did you get that from? Because in the legislation, we talk about 7. So, yes, no, it's just to, you know, because, I mean, the whole idea of the tribunal with the maximum and minimum was that we could split it into two meetings, so to speak, with 3 and 3. So I don't know where the 12 comes from. Because we talk about a maximum of 7.
Sorry, I think it's fine, I don't have your phone.
Perhaps
as far as I recall, the bill spoke about it being between 5 and 7. The two add up to 12. I mean, that's slightly the only area where the 12 comes from. But I think it's from this reading.
I just want you to unpack the issue of the Human Rights Commission, the 2007 recommendation that we put forward. The honors, again, should be based on who? Who must carry the flag for this recommendation? And then I just want you to guide us in terms of the issue of marrying the poor and the vulnerable and the competitive market, because what we've been trying to do in a very, very delicate way, that's why we're talking about the leases being in writing, because to deal with the issue of the contract in the competitive market, and then the issue of the landlord governance in terms of the issue of deposit and making sure that there are three, those inspections, three inspection contracts. Now, in terms of the poor and the vulnerable, the rental control and the workout, how do you suggest we marry those two to be in the amendment? Thank you.
Let me just power on to that. I think the poor and the vulnerable are respect to home a big home in the social housing that they can be that can be changed. PIE to be changed. And so on. If the committee had to say to me, how should we do it? I'll go to the legal counsel and come back to the committee with a recommendation if you believe that that's what you would like to see, is how this should be done. I would have to just take legal counsel on that. But I would suggest that you put the governance and the contracts and all that in the rental housing, the tribunal, all that sort of stuff, which is good stuff, and that applies to the whole market, and you can call out specific segments of our citizens that you want to provide them with that petition, and you put that in that piece of legislation that like the Social Housing Act as an example. That's what I was suggesting. So your other question was? Oh, the Human Rights Commission. It's possible a number of communities complaining to the Human Rights Commission that there were a whole lot of abuses that took place when they were being elected. And there were hearings held over a period of about 3 or 4 days. And each of the people or parties involved in that process came leading from the states, banks, the sheriffs, the state agents, said all the presentations. And two material things came out for us. The one was the need for regulation. All unregulated intermediaries should be regulated. You had a lot of fly-by-night valuations taking place. You had false sales taking place with the banks who had false, who had unscrupulous people running away, claiming to be a state agent but not being registered, running away with the deposits and so on. There's a whole raft of stuff there. But then the second outcome of that was the Human Rights Commission noted that families that fell on hard times, and at a point in time they were able to purchase a property in the market or rent a property in the market, and they could afford to do that, and then they lost their job, and through no cause of their own, they are now destitute, and they had absolutely nowhere to go. And therefore what you found is that you had a lot of community action trying to prevent evictions from taking place, you had a lot of conflict with sheriffs and so on, and one of the rulings was, one of their recommendations was, is that there's an onus on the state to also look after those families that have now come on hard times. They may not have been in hard times, but they now find themselves in hard times. And our entire housing subsidy program is focused on first-time buyers and so on. It doesn't cater for that. And they were suggesting that there needs to be some form of support mechanism for those families that are vulnerable and poor. And post those hearings, we entered into that pilot project with Joburg Metro to look at that. And we had great success out of that. But of course, it again becomes a burden for government. And the problem is your poor local municipalities don't have a policy in place that actually supports those vulnerable families. And I think a lot of the attempts by family
somehow, and so they will do anything to actually stay in their property. And that's the resistance that the prof was talking about earlier on, because they know they're going nowhere, and there is no social security blanket to actually help them. There's two opportunities. The one is for a subsidy program to deal with the destitute and the poor. They find themselves in that circumstance. The second is that I think there should be an attempt to create some form of insurance policy that if I lose my job today, that for a period of 3 or 6 months or whatever it is, my rental would be paid on my profit or my bond would be paid, a bond repayment would take place, that I wouldn't get evicted for that period and gives me leave over 3 or 6 months to go and find alternative employment. And if I can't do it in that period, then I'll become the destitute and the poor. That constitutional court ruling says it's an onus on the municipality to provide me with that alternative accommodation.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fender. We appreciate your presentation, and you are more than welcome. You are coming again, right? Are you aware that next week or the other week you are coming here to us and report on Shamda? Yes. Yes, we have a message. I don't know, but they're supposed to come and report to Parliament. How far are you in the implementation of summer? Thank you very much. You are also welcome to listen to other presenters, but if you have got other businesses, you are list. Thank you. For 10 minutes. To listen to the representatives from the Human Resource Center, you forgive me. I'm very much my time. Sometimes you can't speak like in other names, Mr. Tahanovich. Am I calling you correctly? Okay, thank you very much. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and first of all, thank you to you and the committee for inviting us. And we are pleased to join you in what I think is correct to reflect as an endeavour that the Professor pointed us to this morning, an endeavour in which we are trying to ensure that the rights that are set out in the Constitution are fulfilled for all. And I think this is worth reminding all of us sitting in this committee that the right in particular that we're grappling with is Section 26. And what everybody is doing here is fulfilling the right in 26.2 that reads the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve the progressive realization of that right. And I think that, and I hope that our contribution today assists the committee in ensuring that those rights are fulfilled. As we've put in paragraph 1, we commend the committee for its decision to comprehensively review the current legislative framework for the rental housing sector. We agree with some of the comments made earlier that the review could possibly be more extensive, but maybe that's for the next parliament. I don't think that that is a reason for curtailing the current job. The committee's been in it for quite a long time, and I think that there are a large number of clauses in the proposed bill that are advantageous and if possible to go through as soon as possible. A number of these speakers have drawn attention to court decisions, and I, as an introduction, wish to remind all that the Constitutional Court has grappled with the Rental Housing Act relatively recently, and in the Mahungu and others case, heard in 2012, also heard in 2012, the courts spelt out what our approach should be to this legislation. I think that's just worth repeating. I'm not quoting from the judge, I'm quoting from the head note where they said the majority of the court found that both the High Court and the Supreme Court, in looking at a particular tenant-landlord relationship, had focused on the contractual arrangements between the parties. They had failed to appreciate the impact of this Act, of the Rental Housing Act. The Act, the court held, superimposed an unfair practice regime on the contractual arrangements that individual parties negotiate. And I think it's really important that we recognize that when we are grappling with the Rental Housing Act, we are changing the law. We are changing the relationship between landlord and tenant. For many years, the law used to encourage what was effectively an unequal relationship. And what our law is now trying to do with this act that Parliament has passed and has seen implemented over numerous years is to ensure that despite the fact that there may be old aspects in the law of contract that are unfair and unequal, there is a greater fairness between those who rent property out and those who are the tenants in them. And that is what Parliament seeks today to do, is to encourage more and more of that fairness. And I think some of that has been achieved in the book. And we'll canvass that as we go along. But then, first of all, because I really want to highlight it, I want to turn to the one part of the bill that I have serious problems with. I thought I should highlight that first. And it really dealt with at section 4 of our submission, which is at, I don't have all the page numbers, but it headed arbitrary because it's page 10, I'm sorry. And as you'll note, there is somehow or other placed into this bill the definition of arbitrary evictions. And quite a lot of us have looked at it. We're really a little bit confused as to why it has even been placed in the bill. The constitution that I've just referred to is the source of the term arbitrary evictions. Section 26(3) says that no one may be evicted from their home or have their home demolished without an order of court made after considering all relevant circumstances. And then it says that there may be no legislation that may permit arbitrary evictions. That's the source of the term. It's not defined in the Constitution. It hasn't been defined in any other housing legislation. This piece of legislation that we've been dealing with now, the Rental Housing Act, not only doesn't define it and never has defined it, but Section 13(4) of this Act is very express. It says the tribunal does not have jurisdiction to hear applications for eviction orders. So why on earth a definition of arbitrary eviction should suddenly be placed, I would say, almost unilaterally into the definition section of an act to which it is not relevant, I'm a bit confused. So we come here to encourage that the committee should seriously consider deleting that from the bill in its entirety. We do that not only because we can't find relevance, but because we have a very serious concern. As I pointed out, it's not defined anywhere else. And what we worry is that litigants in other matters may suddenly grab this definition, not considered, not worked out in that legislation, let's say in PIE, or in the Social Housing Act, or somewhere else, and use the definition that's being proposed here and start raising that in other court cases and to be used in, to interpret other legislation. The term an eviction has been subject of dozens and dozens and dozens of cases since the advent of democracy. The Constitutional Court has probably considered issues of eviction in relation to individual rights almost more than any other particular event. It's grappled with this and has set out, and this is what I agree with the Banking Association, quite a lot of debates about what eviction is. To now bring in a definition of arbitrary eviction out of the blue into this piece of legislation without taking all of that into account and inviting lawyers, landlords, tenants to open up a whole new debating area around the new meaning of arbitrary eviction because of this clause in a situation where this piece of legislation simply doesn't call for it, I think would be almost playing with a certain amount of fire in regards to the landlord-tenant relationship. And so I'm to seriously suggest that there be reconsideration of it and that the committee consider deleting that clause entirely from the definition section. And I'll be interested when we get to question time as to whether anybody has other reasons for it being there, because I'd like an opportunity to comment on that. Final part about that particular definition is that I'm certain if anybody speaking has really even looked at it, because I've said it comes from the Constitution, it's not necessary in this Act because it's not relevant, But in addition, if you look at the words themselves, I suggest that they're particularly misleading, because it says that arbitrary eviction includes depriving a tenant of occupation of a dwelling without an order of court made after considering of all the relevant circumstances. And if you look at that wording, if somebody or another is a tenant and they voluntarily leave somewhere because the landlord has asked them to do so, and that very often is, that's not unusual. Very often somebody comes to the end of a lease, landlord, and tenant agrees there won't be a renewal. Or sometimes the landlord has to go to a tenant and say, we're doing building and we want you to move, and these are the other things that are going to happen. You know, court orders there. There the person is leaving without an order of court and they've considered all the relevant circumstances. On the current wording in the definition, that voluntary departure by tenant could well constitute a arbitrary eviction. I would suggest that that would actually create even more problems for us. So once again, I want to report that our submission is that this definition should be deleted from the bill, and we don't think it will be doing any harm to the bill if you so decide. Now, having dealt with what we had taken equal objection to, we now want to comment on some other aspects of the bill. And I turn now to the main machinery of enforcement in the bill, and really is the question of the tribunals. And I just want to associate myself with some of the earlier comments made by the chair and others, that the tribunals are really been doing an impressive and an incredible job in assisting the relationship between landlords and tenants. They do it to a very large extent in a cooperative and mediation way. A large number of the cases that go there do not necessarily have to have decisions. And as an institution, I think that they can be proud of work that they do in Parliament and happily applaud that they've managed to ensure that there is a fairer relationship between landlords and tenants than we've ever seen before. They also provide something that's accessible, understandable, quite honestly, in comparison to what happens in court, relatively inexpensive. Most of the people who go there are able to go there without lawyers. I just want to make two observations. I was recently there with a client, and in the course of 2 hours, a dispute that had been carrying on for ages got resolved. That's not something that's easy to equal in a magistrate's court, where you may very well land up for ages and ages. I've also had opportunity to visit what's called the housing courts in Manhattan in New York City. Of a morning, you can find a queue of anything up to 2,000 people in what is one of the largest cities in the world, with thousands of people renting apartments. And in a way, I think that we need to note that that's where cities go. More and more people land up being tenants, a whole range of ways, and more people who are tenants and landlords will desperately require a place where you can see quick, efficient, and fair resolution of disputes. So I would encourage Parliament, as they go through this review of this legislation, that they must grow the rental housing tribunals. They must give more and more recognition to them and ensure that they have the necessary resources to do the work that they are doing well. So we, in Section 2 of the bill, start talking about new roles, training people, etc., to carry out that work. It is particularly important that you encourage and adopt that particular section. If you'll just grant me a second, I just want to get to the relevant page that I can refer you to it. Now, page 3, and there we point out, given that the vital role the tribunals are beginning to perform, we encourage the committee to consider this extension that the tribunals not only grow but are independent from provincial departments. We must try and ensure that they, over time, will be able to have their own budgets and have a certain amount of independence, so that whatever may be going on in a department or in the MEC's office, the tribunals can continue their work effectively. Now, in doing that, the bill has suggested a slight growth and an increase in numbers in regard to the tribunals. We want to suggest that there's another way of encouraging that growth. And there I refer you to paragraph 8 on page 4. We said we would encourage the committee to consider reconfiguring the minimum requirements to reduce the number of members required for a tribunal to function. Chair, you pointed out earlier how for North and South Gauteng, you would see 6, maybe 7 members, 3 going to the South and 3 going to the North. then possibly getting together and considering it. We'd like to suggest that Gauteng's figures suggest that 6 or 7 members, 2 sitting there, 1 sitting there, as allocated by the chairperson. Some may have to deal with a small dispute, some may have to deal with a big dispute. Moving around are going to be able to turn this into a far more efficient machinery of dispute resolution in respect to the disputes between landlord and tenant. And as an analogy, we wish to point you to places like the CCMA, which also deal with disputes between employer and employee, where over time the CCMA and its officials, one person at a time, can actually resolve a dispute, and the director of the CCMA in the area sometimes might ask you commissioners to get involved and recall some more, it's more complicated disputes. But we think the proposal that insists that every time a tribunal sits, there should be at least 3 people involved may well not be the most economical way of going about this. And if the committee finds favour with trying to have more commissioners independent but sitting singly or 2 at a time, 3 at a time, something in something that may be more complicated, we would be happy to get together with the legal advisors and see if we can devise the appropriate wording that would then ensure that that type of increased capacity with no extra cost and that then that currently proposed by the committee would be able to service this whole rental area. We also suggested in paragraph 14 that with the increase in work code, these tribunals should have full-time members. And we've also suggested the manner in which their qualifications are set out in the bill at the moment are slightly complex. It's a particularly difficult task for the NEC doing appointments, and in paragraph 15 we have set out the same qualifications as you have suggested, but in a slightly simpler manner, that each person being appointed must have at least one of the following areas of expertise, but not trying to balance 2 or 3 areas of expertise within each person and causing the MEC in the area a fairly difficult task of finding the appropriate people. That in a way deals with the tribunal, and we're suggesting that they should have enhanced capacity. They'll be able to get decisions and deal with people in a much more efficient manner. It then comes to the issue of the appeal body. And I think that the draft will be absolutely correct in encouraging an appeal body within the Act. At the moment, the only way in which an aggrieved person at the tribunal can deal with the problem is to take via section, I think it's 17, is that right, on review to the High Court. And all of us sitting there know, first of all, that that can be an incredibly expensive exercise. Just as an example, if somebody is aggrieved by a decision at a tribunal and they have spent the day at the tribunal in a hearing and they want to take it on review, the first thing they're going to have to do is get a record of that tribunal. Simply getting that record is going to cost them several thousand rand. That's before they even have to file any papers. Just get it typed up and transcribed so they can then take it and presume at that stage either the landlord or the tenant has dealt with the matter him or herself. They get the several thousand pages, they get it printed, and then they've got to take it along to a lawyer so that they can actually start the review process. So I'm very supportive of the idea that we need to see some type of appeal procedure. They don't do away with people's right to review if they want to, but at least if there's an appeal procedure as suggested, it starts ensuring that there is greater fairness. And just in case the first hearing makes an error, we've got to acknowledge that sometimes happens, there will be an appeal process available to the aggrieved landlord or tenant. At the moment, the manner of appointing and selecting members of the appeal as provided in the bill strikes me as a little unusual. Because what the bill proposes is that the appeal members will actually be nominated or selected by the tribunal members themselves. And I don't think we can be particularly comfortable with that. The idea that anybody sitting on a tribunal should have the right to decide who will listen to appeals from them strikes me as fairly unusual. And we'd like to suggest that tribunal members are to be appointed by the MEC, and very possibly the appeal members could be appointed by the MEC. That's one possibility. The other is it should be appointed by the Premier in consultation with the MEC. And that will then ensure that the tribunal appeal members are in a way recognized with a slightly higher authority via the
political authority appoints them than the bill currently proposes. It's submitted that this committee should require members of the appeal body to be fit and proper persons. It should consider an appointment process for appeal bodies that matches is more rigorous than that of tribunal members, and that it will then ensure that you get people who can sit in an appeal on the hard work done by the tribunal, and everybody can have in what they may emerge with. If we are going to have tribunals with up to 3 members, I would suggest that the appeal body itself has to constitute a minimum of 3 members. And we set out those provisions at paragraph 21 and 22 of our submission. Chair, I just wanted to comment on one thing that you raised earlier when you were talking about 3 members going to the south and 3 members going to the north of Gauteng, and then getting together to decide as the tribunal what the decision should be. And two aspects that struck me as slightly problematic, and I think I should put them on record. First of all, it worries me that it may delay decisions, but the more important one is that you would then have a meeting where 3 people who did not hear the evidence may end up actually being part and parcel of a decision. And I think you're very possibly reading that into the draft at the moment, because the draft reads the tribunal may function as 2 committees, each with 3 members. But I would submit that if one reads that and subjects it to legal principles, it would be incorrect for people who are not part of hearing evidence to be part of the decision. So I would suggest that even if you don't go, that we suggest that for tribunals with 8 members making decisions, that if 3 people go off to South Gauteng, they should make the decision as the 3 without discussing it with other members, because that would then place the functioning possibly at risk of being reviewed by a higher court. That really deals with our submissions in regard to the tribunals and the appeal bodies. I now want to turn to the ultimate section, which really has to deal with the rental standards. And that is at section 3. The first part of that crops up in the draft rule is a question of whether leases should be reduced to writing. And we would strongly encourage that that does happen. It ensures that there is certainty. It ensures that parties understand what they've got. But I understand that in earlier deliberations there was concern that if you do that and then there isn't a written lease, does that invalidate the lease and cause problems with occupancy? I'm going to suggest that there is actually a way around that, that the failure to provide a written lease should simply be an offence, and the landlord can then be penalised for doing it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the lease doesn't continue to operate. And again, should the committee find favour with that, we would be happy to work with the legal advisors to look at a way of enshrining that. We're now in a position where sort of 13 years after the Rental Housing Act, the Minister quite often has failed to comply with the provisions in Section 15, making procedures and making regulations relating to all of the aspects. So we welcome the Bill's requirement that the Minister must issue regulations in terms of Section 15.1, B, F and FA within 12 months, that mandatory provision that will put pressure on the particular MECs. And allow those who are aggrieved if the MECs don't do it to the court to seek the court order that they do, I think is a great advance. We also welcome the insertion of Section 15.1 4FB into the Act. That is really welcome because it would mandate norms and standards. We know that the Minister is obliged to consult before putting those out, but we think that all of this will enhance the working of this piece of legislation and ensure that the fairness that the Constitutional Court has set out in its 2012 decision becomes more and more known, practiced and implemented. We notice this insertion of the provision that deals with the calculation method for the escalation of rentals, and we welcome that too. Members may recall that there was once in the 70s and 80s applying to only part of the South African population a Rent Control Act. That Rent Control Act also ensured that there was a way in which there could be objections to rental that were unnecessarily and dramatically increased.
this particular provision, I think, directly looks at that through social legislation and says that there was a good aspect about it, and they're allowing the minister to bring something like that in. Where I think the fails is that, unlike the other subsections of Section 15, where the minister is given, it's a year to bring that into operation, this particular section has not been mentioned as having a time period to it. And I'm going to suggest that there too the committee should require of the minister that within the next 12 months, at least the initial regulation in regard to rental amounts also be provided by way of regulation. It will go out for general comments and then in time to get them. Okay, I'm just checking on the time. Finally, in section 5, there's a heading which says regulations. We should really read regulations, possibly even more importantly, monitoring. We did have a look at the earlier versions, and somehow or another, a monitoring provision that had been in one of the early bills seems to have slipped off the table. And we would suggest that there is advantage to reinsert the clause of the 2011 bill, which requires the minister to monitor and assess, and importantly, to annually report to the Assembly on the promotion of rental housing, so as to ensure that there is continual growth and pressure on all parties concerned to ensure that that growth happens. In conclusion, we're available for questions, and once again to repeat, however, that if there are objections that the committee would like to work on, we can work with the letters, with the lawyers involved. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, in my experience, I've never heard lawyers agree on this. But we are listening to the lawyer and we are going to listen to you. But that is another comment. It's not offending anybody. But in my experience, I am that way too. But again, I want to please the member, but I wanted to assist you on page 18 on section 10. It's not under a membership. Section 9 or 10. Because now 10B1, the tribunal consists of 4 or 7 members who are fit and proper persons appointed by the minister, I mean by the MEC. So the mentioning of the secretary is just a procedural matter. It's a administration, but the person who has got an authority to appoint is the MEC. We remember members, we discussed this matter and we finally agreed with the department. So, okay. MEC appoints. So the secretariat just following the processes, and so the minister can, MEC will not follow all those processes. The secretariat.
Okay. Can I clarify that? Yes. I think we have slight cross purposes. I agree with you, the provision is at the moment that the tribunal members are all appointed by the HC.
Yes.
While I was addressing you, what I was referring to was in section 17, capital A, sub 3, I was talking about the appeal members. And there, 17A, 3 says, the secretariat must appoint a panel of adjudicators. And I was saying in that particular provision, that shouldn't happen there. That should actually be an appointment, I was suggesting, either by the MEC or by the appointed by the Secretariat or by members of the Tribunal. So I just wanted to clarify that for you.
Department. social department. So how then do we separate them all together in terms of facilities? I think the question of the committee, the how they will function, this is with regard to your suggestion about the allocation of the complaints to one member, so that, you know, a lot of work can be done in a short time. But I think the chairperson has explained why we are insisting on, or rather why we are proposing the two committees, at least each one to be composed of three members rather than all seven at the same time. We are also trying to solve the same problem, but I'm not sure if, for instance, we have currently people with that experience, so much experience, that you can actually give them, give the complaint to one member to listen at a time. And I think if we are going to follow the model that I'm suggesting, which is a separate and just explained, that in any case, even the three members, if they meet and they listen to a case, they still have to come to the collective, to the seven. Now, in your case, then if you give them to individuals, say five, six individuals at a time, doesn't it come to the same thing if they are still going to come back to the collective for decisions now to be taken finally by the whole tribunal? Yes, I think also the point about the appointment of the members of the appeal structure to be made by the MPC rather than by the tribunal secretary. I don't know how we are solving that, because that's how we are expected. And then I must comment and say your proposal for us to reinstate section 2, the monitoring and assessment of the impact of this legislation, I think you find that very interesting. When they think of the arguments we had yesterday with the department, we definitely find it very interesting. It will give us food for thought. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Chair. I must say, technical results, you've just dealt with a lot of embarrassing issues here. And yeah, I think as the Chair said, you know, when you put two lawyers in one room, you'll have different interpretation of the same thing. So, what they call legal cement is. But I think what I'm picking up is one thing that you want us to do is strengthen the role of the tribunals. You know, that's what you want us to do. And I think we will tighten the grip as far as the, and you are looking for time frames. The time frames of when will the regulations be, you know, and the time frames of the tribunals, and as well as the issue of the full time of the tribunals. And I think we will take it when we are recrafting the thing. The issue of arbitrary eviction. Yes, I would agree when you say it might not be the one proper definition of it in our draft bill. But I think the reason why arbitrary eviction was placed there was based on, I guess, practical experience of what's happened. Even though the bill is not about dealing specifically with arbitrary eviction, it's just a definition. I mean, it's put there as a definition, but I've never seen it anywhere in the text. Well, that is related to arbitrary. So you might have a point there to say, why do we put it there? You know? So we might have to strike a balance of why do we put it there, while in the text there's no reference to the arbitrary eviction. But if we put it there, then we must put a correct definition of it, so that it doesn't open itself up for legal interpretation. So we will look at that in as far as that is concerned. But I think you're both saying that in as far as the time frame and the offences and the penalty that you are proposing, what are you proposing in terms of the offence? I get the point of putting the teeth in making sure that when the lease is not reduced to writing, what are the penalty, what are the penalties? Because it will tie with the issue of saying, what is the grace period that we're going to give? I mean, even if we say to people, within 12 months you should have your lease in writing,
and they're smoking and I'll kiss to them. Why would I want to go into that as a landlord? So you are correct there. You say the right needs to be a penalty. I'm not sure if within our scope we can make penalties. But you've got a case there, because then why would people want to put it in writing? So we've got to look at that very seriously. And the public participation, yes, regulations will go for public participation. And thank you for your comment. And if you have a question.
Well, thank you so much. The issue that has not been addressed, the issue of the full-time appointment of the tribunals. The tribunals are just like any other board. Yes. They are not an agent, like housing development agents. So, I don't think it will be even the cost of that. It means the wage paid for government is going to be, there is going to be impact on the wage bill if we consider the appointment, the full-time appointment, because that's just like any other post. That is a point. For instance, the HDA has got a board member, so they are not full-time in their appointment. They are part-time. So definitely there will be complications. So I don't think the department is constant that. So it means in future amendments after 5 years from now, maybe it could be considered, but now I don't think it is going to be proper to consider it. Thank you. Please, can we respond?
Let me start on the question of the tribunal composition. And I think that in that regard, we, in a way, having three levels to the debate. The first one is what the current tribunal arrangement is. The tribunal sits as its members, there are different numbers in each province, but they normally sit as one particular panel and they listen to the grievance that come before them, and they make collective decisions announced by either the chair or somebody else. The current proposal in the bill is that there can be anything between 5 and 7 persons appointed in each province, and that the chair would then say members A, B, and C go to place Z, and members D, E, and F go to the other place and go and hear those particular matters. Once they've heard them, this is part of the debate the chair and I were having, once they heard them, the chair suggested they would make a provisional decision and they all come together. And then through the provisional chair, they would get a final decision. I'm suggesting that on the proposal which is in the bill at the moment, the 3-year, whatever it is in place A, need to make a decision there, and the 3-year in place B need to make a decision there, because you run the legal risk that if you put them all together, some of the people who are involved in the decision-making will be people that have not heard the evidence. I'm suggesting that that could be legally problematic, and a high court would intervene and say that people who haven't heard evidence shouldn't be making decisions of this nature. That's really the second part of the debate. The third part is the proposal that we've made, and it's a proposal which sees sees the rent on housing tribunals acknowledging that they're going to get busier and busier, and that they would benefit in much the same way as the CCMA has grown. They would benefit from having both, and I'm going to change slightly, both part-time and full-time commissioners hearing matters. That the chair would know the nature of complaint and would allocate, be it 1, 2, or 3 people to go and deal with a particular dispute, and that person or people together would have to make a decision on each of those, and in that manner, you may only have 7 tribunal members right across the province, but you would be able to deal with more matters more expeditiously and quickly and more efficiently. And I think that it means that not everybody is experienced, but you can put an experienced and inexperienced person together, and fairly soon the inexperienced person will gather that experience And that is what you would end up doing whether you have persons acting all together or you just do it in twos and threes. But I'm looking at ways in which we can look towards all of this becoming much more efficient. Chair, on the question of the equivalent of saying it's not like the AGA, I agree it's not like the AGA. The AGA isn't independent and it's got board members. These are not board members. These are adjudicators in much the same way as the CCMA is adjudicators or the High Court is but adjudicators. And sometimes the matter is heard and decided by one person at the CCMA or by one judge or by one magistrate, and sometimes there are more. And that is something that the chair of the panel in each sex would have to decide depending on how busy they are, how many complaints they got, and the intricacy of the matter. And I think that in that way we can develop progressive realization of access to housing in a manner in which its dispute resolution becomes more and more and better serviced by the rental housing tribunal. So that really, in a way, is a response to all the different questions that raised around the question of committees. Mama, thanks for the explanation of where all the evictions came in and why it came in there, and I understand why it came in there. Because I do know that the tribunals often have people come in and say, look, I've been arbitrarily evicted, I'm now looking for a remedy. If that person wants a remedy which has been reinstated and where they've gone to, they would normally go to either a magistrate or to more often I would. But they may very well be at the tribunal and they may well be saying, I want my deposit back, I want damages because you threw me out too much before the end of the rent or whatever. And they would then be saying that there's been an arbitrary eviction. But what they would also be saying is they would effectively be saying, I have been evicted in a manner that is contrary either to PIN. This is where you need to be cautious for this. I don't want a new definition. The evicted may be contrary to PIN. It may be contrary to Esther. It may be contrary to the contract that they signed. Now, in all three of those instances, that eviction would have been unlawful and they very well have a claim before the tribunal. If we now then create another definition, as is proposed, of arbitrary evictions, we won't actually have canvassed and covered all of those three options that I've already mentioned, and the difference in this, again, the Banking Association points out to AMPRA, Professor, the multitude of decisions of the Constitutional Court which have looked at ways in which evictions might end up being unlawful and therefore subject to a decision by a tribunal about what remedy they should offer agreements. So I'm suggesting that while it's not relevant in the legislation itself, not mentioned anywhere else, I'm not suggesting that we go and artificially create another clause so as to make it all comfortable. I think if we simply delete the reference to arbitrary evictions, we don't have a definition, it's going to leave everybody in a more severe position and actually more knowledgeable about what the position is than introducing a new definition to our jurisprudence. There was a further question on the independence of tribunals. And it's a difficult issue because what I foresee is a progression. The tribunals were first set up, were very much set up with right within the department in much the same way as in the Labour Department at some stage the dispute resolution system was internal. But as much as there are tens and hundreds of thousands of people in a labour relationship between employer and employee, there are as many involved in the relationship between landlord and tenant. And I think we need to recognise that this area is going to grow enormously. And if we are going to grow it enormously, we must set the framework to allow it to happen. And allowing the tribunals, not all of the staff members, not the office of the local authority. The office of the local authority is an advising office that assists people who are there to find out what the law is, how it works, how do you process complaints. But the tribunal section can be given an independence and an ability to grow. In some provinces it may take place a little faster than others because there's greater demand, greater resources, greater experience. It strikes me if one looks at the reports from Gauteng, they're in a position where they could probably run 6 or 7 offices around the province hearing matters and get their own budget. It may very well be, Chair, you mentioned the Eastern Cape one only recently opened. Maybe they would have gone through a couple of those things, but I would suggest that it would be helpful if the legislation facilitated a process where that independence can be question of, we seem to find agreement on the question of the appointment to the appeal officers. We seem to have support of the idea of reintroducing the monitoring body in the last section. Penalties. There was the question of penalties. Section 16 of the current Act has a provision, like in every piece of legislation almost, for penalties that arise in the course of the implementation of that particular Act. This one, Section 16, says if people don't comply with the following sections, the end shall be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 2 years or so to both a fine and such imprisonment. That's what the current Act provides for, and it may well simply be a question of adding to Section 16 that if you have not complied with the section to put a lease in writing, you would also be liable to a similar type fine or imprisonment, and then you have the, it just falls under the general penalty clause. I think I'm done, Chair. Thank you very much for your time.
15 minutes. Well, thank you so much. So I think we are going to look at the recommendations that you have made, and we'll consider them, and then we'll get feedback from us once we are home. Otherwise, there's still a contestation on the decision of the individual. Can't be. Because if a person feel aggrieved, that person is aggrieved to the tribunal. So, sending applies those people who are not there. How are they going to support the decision? So, there's still a contestation on that one. But it's not for the day to finalize it. We're still going to discuss it. Because at the end of the day, the mandate has been given to a tribunal, not to an individual. Remember, it's lunchtime.
Okay, may I ask if you are excused for the afternoon?
Oh, okay. No, you are excused. Okay. We're going to come back at 2 o'clock we are starting. 5 to 2 we are here. Sitting. Okay.